Hey, CS Psychos, welcome to today's episode. We're thrilled to have Ali Cudby with us. She is the founder and CEO of Alignment Growth Strategies and a leader in enhancing businesses through better customer experiences. Ali is the author of the best-selling book, Keep Your Customers, where she introduces her MINT method, M-I-N-T. And this strategy has helped many companies improve customer loyalty and growth. She has a career spanning over 20 years, like me, including roles at the New York Times and teaching entrepreneurship at Purdue University. She brings a wealth of experience in strategic marketing and business leadership. And today she's going to share her insights on how to measure levels of loyalty to drive engagement and revenue through your customer experience department. That's all coming up next. Stay tuned. That's all coming up next, right here on Psychology of Customer Success. Stay tuned. Humans don't think or behave like computers. You can't just run a command and get them to do what you want them to do. So why are you still basing your CS strategy based solely on logic? I'm Rachel Provan, CS leadership coach, award-winning CS strategist, and certified psych nerd. I teach CS leaders how to build and scale world-class CS departments using a combination of strategy, leadership, and mindset, using my secret weapon, psychology. Come join me every Wednesday for Psychology of Customer Success, where we'll dive into why people do the things they do, what motivates them, and the effect that has on your CS strategy, team dynamics, and executive presence. Make sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and make sure to share it with your CS bestie. Talk soon, and here's to your success. So, Ali, thank you so much for being here today. I am so excited to talk to you. I had met you at the Big Rig sort of me conference in New York City where you were presenting, and I just was such a fangirl and I couldn't stop like nodding along. Like I actually hurt my neck from nodding so much and rushed you afterwards because you are very much in alignment with talking about not only customer success, but really understanding the psychology of your customers. So can you just tell us a little bit about you, what you do, and a little bit about customer loyalty, how that factors in?
Sure. I am the CEO of a company called Alignment Growth Strategies, Alignment, M-I-N-T. When you plant mint, it grows like crazy. And when you make a lot of money, you make a mint. So
I love it.
Yeah. And I've been working in the customer loyalty and retention space for more years than I really care to count at this point. Same. And it's really my passion. This idea of you can make other people's lives better by delivering an experience that makes them feel seen, heard, and valued. It's one of those real win-win parts of business when done right. And so by being able to work with companies and help them create clear and consistent processes that help them do this right, that's a good way to spend your time.
Now, I love that you said that you can make people's lives better. Because I think that so many of us in the customer success field, that's something that's important to us. Like we like helping others. We like seeing a positive impact on the world. And even if that's just through working with the software, like, hey, we're making someone's life easier. We're making it quicker, you know, better. It doesn't have to be that we're like completely upending their life and changing it for the better. We can do a small thing and that still counts. That still matters. There are still ripple effects from small things.
Absolutely. And by the way, that's good business.
Yeah.
The idea that the companies spend a lot of time, energy, and effort focusing on front-end sales. And okay, cool and important. But if you bring customers into a broken back end, then you're not helping them, but you're really not helping your business. Companies make money by keeping their customers, not by bringing a lot of people in and churning them out.
That's something that I think most people either don't know or know technically, but haven't internalized.
I know. And it makes so much sense. It's so logical. It kind of boggles my mind that I'm still having to have the conversation.
I know.
Because there's still this sort of all hail front end sales mentality I know I have my pet theories on why, but it just doesn't make business sense. Like when you run the numbers, it doesn't make business sense.
I would agree with you. Yeah, I was watching something on that earlier today, but I think it's because they think once they're in the door, we're so fantastic that they'd never leave. That's all we had to do is get them in the door. And while I understand that mentality, because you built it to the best of your ability, like you've thought of everything that your brain can think of, that doesn't mean someone's not going to come in and mess it up, because that's what we humans do best. Talk to me a little bit more about customer loyalty. You were talking about how there are different kinds and different levels of loyalty. And I thought that was so interesting. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. So I was talking about that at the RIG Turn Zero sponsored in New York, but it's also a part of my book, Keep Your Customers. And I break down loyalty into these three tiers. And the tiers are lazy loyals, limited loyals, and lucrative loyals. And the lazy loyals are the customers that are they're the convenience customers. They're really just with you because they happen to trip and fall into your business. And the example that I like to give is, you know, if there's a coffee shop in the lobby of your office and you go there every day to grab your Java mochaccino on the way upstairs, then that's a company that's going to get a lot of revenue out of you, but not necessarily a lot of loyalty. And as soon as you get a job in a different office, you're going to stop patronizing their business. And you know, that's a very distinct type of loyalty. Then there's this middle tier of limited loyalty. And the example that I like to give is your travel rewards programs, where there is some loyalty there. And you do prefer one, you know, like airline or car rental company or hotel chain, because it conveys benefits to you. But it's only to a point. You know, it's not the convenience customer like the lazy loyal, but it's a little bit more like the convince me customer. And you know, those are the people who are, you know, like, you need to keep showing them the money in some ways. You know, they're going to stick with you as long as you keep delivering something that pulls them along. And, you know, I've been sort of saying this year, I've been a real Delta loyalist for a long time, and they just revamped their SkyMiles program this year. And I am looking at my travel patterns and saying, is this still my airline? And so, you know, it's one that you're evaluating. And so that's the limited loyal. And then there's the lucrative loyal. And these are the people that are emotionally invested in the products and services that you deliver. And you know, you may have some thoughts like off the top of your head, like, yeah, I am a lucrative loyal for X or Y company. The ones that tend to come up when I ask the question are, you know, more B2C examples. So I tend to hear Chewy, or I used to hear a lot more Zappos, but the ones that there's that emotional connection to, where you feel like being a customer of this company, that matters to me. Like I somehow, I care about being their customer on some, some level.
It's interesting that you mentioned Apple, because I think of that as, and I, this is ridiculous, but like, I feel like being their customer says something about me, which you, and I don't know what it says, but it's like, oh, I'm not using any other type of things. Like, right. I feel like it identifies me in a certain camp, even though I don't know what it is, but I like it. What do you think most companies fall into? Which camp?
I think that there are generally not that many lucrative loyals in a company. Sure. But what I think is that companies mistake their lazy loyals for lucrative loyals. And that way lies danger, because if you are looking at somebody and you're thinking like, they're really with us and they're really just there for the convenience, you can make bad decisions in trying to please them or attract more of them. And so teasing out the difference, especially between those lazy loyals and the lucrative loyals, is so important. You can just have a few lucrative loyals and learn so much from them. But if you mix them up with the other kinds of loyals, then that, you know, you can really get pulled into wrong directions. So I think that kind of depends, you know, industry to industry, but I think there are the few of the lucrative loyals. I think companies tend to have a lot of limited loyals, especially these days. I'd say that there's probably somewhat of an even split between lazy and limited, and not as many lucrative.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I'm not emotionally invested with most of my purchases beyond the fact that it's like, oh, that's a lot of money. But yeah, exactly. But since it is so important to tease those things apart, I have a two-part question here. How do you do that? How do you identify that and tell the differentiators there? And then once you do, what should you do with that knowledge?
So you really want to look at the customer's behavior. So how are they engaging with you? How are they engaged in the conversations? But in a world where you are having ongoing conversations with your customers, you can learn a lot by how they engage, you know, how they show up to business review meetings, how they, you know, whether or not they want to be a part of your customer advisory board. And that's the conversation with you. But a lot of the clues also come from how they engage away from you. So what you want to be looking for, you know, are they spontaneously talking about you in the marketplace? You know, referrals are great if they are authentic referrals and testimonials, as opposed to the ones where, you know, you ask somebody to post and they're like, yeah, Shay, that's fine. If they're spontaneously posting about you and saying good things, that's a real sign that you have a lucrative loyal. And those are the cues that you start looking for, you know, especially referrals and talking about outside of the relationship.
That makes a ton of sense. I have a couple companies that I like refer insanely, like I all the time. But question, I'm thinking of this in terms of customer success, and because advocacy is so important and because people are much more easily convinced by their peers than they are the person trying to sell it to them. As companies and as CS, we do try to foster advocacy wherever we can. So are we shooting ourselves in the foot when we do that by then not knowing if we have lucrative loyals?
Not if you're teasing out the differences. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong. There are tactics that are not authentic loyalty. Punch card loyalty is not authentic loyalty.
No. Yeah.
And, you know, asking somebody to post a review on G2 or whatever it is, and then saying, look, we have this fabulous review. That's not authentic. That's, they may, what they said may have been true, but they didn't spontaneously produce it.
Right.
And you have the ability to tease those things apart. And that's what I would encourage people to look at. And then look at the value of your customer, not just on the revenue that they bring in, but on the value of that indirect revenue as well. Because you can have a customer that's small in terms of their actual revenue contribution to you, but A, they're giving you all of their share of wallet. They're fully invested in who you are, which is another way to identify a lucrative loyal. And they're telling other people to come to you. And so their actual total contribution to your company can be really big. Whereas those big whales can be, you know, not at all invested and in fact can take you off track. But so sometimes the big clients with the big dollar numbers, they seem so attractive, but these little guys that actually talk about you in the marketplace more can generate a lot of value for your company.
So what do you do if you know you have a lucrative loyal, or you have, let's say you have like a small group that you've identified as lucrative loyals, like what would you do with them other than just mark them as lucrative loyal?
Well, so because these people are invested in what you do, they're excited to have a conversation with you. And so I would engage with them. And there's a company that I use for my email called ActiveCampaign, and that I am a lucrative loyal for them. And one of the things that they did at some point was, and I would, they already had me when they did this, but they really anchored me when they did, is they, I got an email out of the blue one day from them saying, you were one of our favorite customer support calls this month. And so here's a link, go to our swag store and pick out anything in the swag store and we'll send, you know, thank you for being a good customer. And that little thing made such an impression on me. And
yeah,
it's such an easy thing to do. And so whether you are rewarding people who were pleasant in your interactions, or whether you're being a little bit more strategic and saying, let's identify either our lucrative loyals or maybe some limited loyals that we think we have an opportunity to upgrade their level of loyalty. So let's give them that recognition. Let's take a moment and make them feel special. That's a really small investment in relationship building.
That is really powerful. I normally don't think swag does much, but in that situation where you're expecting absolutely nothing, and I think this is probably similar for you in that working in the field we work with, I am nauseatingly pleasant to customer support, customer success, anyone in a service position. Now I'm like, well, I haven't gotten rewarded for it. Nobody's called me out. And I'm fine with that. But it does make them so much happier, just like it made me so much happier. Like, what a pleasant person. What a nice surprise.
Yes.
And it's not that hard.
Yeah, I cared very little about the water bottle.
Right? Of course.
But
you were special.
Yes, and it did make me feel special, and it was really memorable. And it's actually one of the downsides of this world of AI that we're going into is that everything feels so inauthentic now. Or at least you sit there, I want to be flattered, you know. I'm I'm just a girl standing in front of a screen, but every outreach that I get that's like, I love what you're doing at Aligned and Growth Strategy, Allie. Do you?
Yeah.
And you know, it is something that you can do that just feels like it's going enough beyond that it feels like, oh, they're not going to do this for everybody.
Right. Yeah. And it actually takes a minute of consideration, of thought. And we've all got a little pick me energy when it's like, oh, we actually were talking about you in a positive way. And you don't think of a company talking about you. Do we have their money? Okay, good.
Or, oh my God, you're never going to believe this call.
Oh, yeah.
But then they talk about you.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, for sure.
So let me say this. You said something interesting that my ears perked up. You said that there are limited loyals that you can possibly turn into lucrative loyals. How does that work?
So for the most part, the way that you move people who are open to being moved into higher levels of loyalty is by making them feel seen, heard, and valued. And the way that you do that most of the time is not through the razzle dazzle, and it's not through sending them swag. It's through delivering really great customer experience that makes them feel seen, heard, and valued. And so playbooks are your anchor go-to move for how do you do this in a consistent way in your company? Because at a certain point, you want to hire good people with good instincts, but you don't want to rely on those instincts for their interactions because you need a company way of doing things.
Yes.
And you want to give people, your people, a path to being successful in their work with you. And that's where playbooks come into play.
But no, it makes sense. It's operationalizing best practices, which sounds so sterile, but I think we're talking about is introducing warmth and caring and humanity into that. I truly believe this is why we'll still have jobs, because that matters. People sense that and they care.
The thing that you can't fake is the part where you're actually like listening and responding and being empathetic and solving problems and giving them a way to grow with your products and services, right? It's not all just like, oh, let me be a good listener. It's being a business listener and resolving not just fixing the problems that they're having, you know, serving them in ways that are better for them that also happen to bring them deeper into your suite of products and services.
Can you give me an example of that?
Sure. So you're in a business review meeting and you hear in conversation some of the things that your client is still struggling with in their business. Like you're having a conversation and they're talking about some of the challenges that they're having or what have you. And you realize that they're not utilizing one of your features as deeply as they may. And you're like, hey, let's put our heads together because I think I might be able to jump in and help you. And maybe it's an upsell, maybe it's not. But by helping solve their problem, And by being that good listener and helping them solve their problem, you're really being a good partner with them in on the business of their growth and yours.
Absolutely. That's what good sales is. It's helping people solve their problems. I always think of that. You're like a doctor listening for symptoms. They're not going to tell you, I have bronchitis. They're going to tell you, I'm coughing and I have a fever. You need to know how to listen to the symptoms and then be able to say, this is your problem and this is what we do to fix that particular problem.
Right.
And I think a lot of people don't know what to listen for. It's kind of complex to tease that out because it's going to look different for different kinds of customers.
And that's why the playbooks can be so helpful, because you can give people things to listen for and you can and mm-hmm. ways to respond. You can really together a sort of a library of great practices. What are the right size practices for your company and how do you engage with them? And then also how do you pull them in at the right moment? The other piece of it is just that your customers are busy and
yes.
your products and services are just like one thing on their plate. And the likelihood that they caught all of those like awesome nuances that you deliver during that onboarding that was probably kind of like drinking from a fire hose, it's probably pretty small. And so you need to repeat yourself a few times anyway, but there's also, there's probably always more that you can be helping them implement. And so it's also listening for that. They bought your thing, they want your thing. Just because they didn't catch it in round one during onboarding doesn't mean that you shouldn't like constantly be looking for ways to bring them deeper into what you've sold them.
That is exactly what my last podcast was about. So thank you. Listen to the episode right before this one, folks. But that makes total sense to me. Something I'm always wondering about in terms of that is trying to balance, serving them enough, helping them enough, giving them enough information, spaced repetition in different formats, maybe for different types of learners. How do you do that and keep in mind that the fact that they are busy and that you are not their entire business? How do you keep from pissing them off, for lack of a better term?
Some of it has to do with right sizing. And then again, like really being thoughtful about how you're using their time. One of the things that makes me bananas is bad business review meetings. Like that is a mm-hmm. gift. That time yeah. is a gift. And if you come into the meeting and you run a monologue for 30 minutes and are like, okay, thanks, bye, or an hour, and you don't use that as an opportunity to build the relationship, listen to what's going on with them, make it a real like business conversation, then shame on you. Honestly.
Yeah.
And I think there's a movement afoot of QBRs are bad. My answer to that is no, your QBRs are bad.
Yeah, like, bad QBRs are bad.
Yeah, bad QBRs are bad. Stop running bad QBRs.
And I would say not every customer needs it to be quarterly. It really depends on, do they need this to help them or are we just trying to do a book report?
Yeah. And again, like that is why there's nothing that's one size fits all. You're listening
yeah.
to the customer. And by the way, that's harder, right? Mm-hmm. What's easier is I'm going to have a quarterly business review meeting and I'm going to come in and I'm going to give you my book report and thank you very much. I'll see you at renewal time. And that's a way easier way to run a company. It's not as effective a way to run a company.
No.
So yeah, I'm suggesting that people be more tailored in their approach. And I'm also suggesting that that's going to reap a lot of benefits on the back end.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I'm going to pivot a little bit because I'm wondering what can prevent a customer from being loyal? And are there any red flags that might make a customer not even worth your time trying to get loyalty from?
Oh, I love talking about that. So bad revenue is one of my favorite soapboxes. companies have customers all the time that were sold into the products and services that shouldn't have been sold into the products and services. And it's very hard to cultivate loyalty from a customer that should have never been sold in the first place. And that is why customer experience is inherently cross-functional and cultural. You have
yes.
to have a sales team where leadership says, no, it's not okay for you to be selling any old person, any old company into what we do. You know, this is who we sell to. And if you go outside of a reasonable approximation of your ICP, your ideal customer profile, you're actually doing the company a disservice. And you truly are.
I think that's a maturity thing too. It's there comes a point at which you have to start saying no to money, and that's hard. And that's why, you know, the whole customer lifetime value, you know, unit economics of it, CLV versus CAC, getting numerical here, but just understanding how long does it actually take to make this customer profitable for us? Like when we take out all we spent in sales and marketing to get them and all we're spending on, you know, cost of goods and services, how long do they have to be a customer for us to make a profit off of one customer? And often it's longer than a year, which is mind-boggling. But at that point, you can be bringing in money, but it's costing you more and you're actually losing money per customer. And I think that's one of those things that we have to keep repeating and showing on graphs because it doesn't make logical sense to us.
Right.
Like it takes some time to explain and it's just, we see money's money. Money in is good. And it's just not always. And that's so hard.
It's not always. Oh, I love this one too. Yes. What they look at oftentimes, as you said, is like customer lifetime value as compared to customer acquisition cost. And that's not the whole story because, oh, no. You know, they're like said it quickly, but I'm going to actually like, it's the cost of acquiring the customer in terms of sales and marketing, but then it is also the cost of serving the customer. And mm-hmm. So that especially gets expensive if they need a lot of extra training or they are asking for product customization or they are, you know, because they're not an ideal customer, they are overextending on, you know, use of the CS team or use of the technical support team, like whatever those things are. And so the cost of serving bad customers is oftentimes just higher once after sales and marketing.
That is so true and so hard to show to the executive team to make them get it. Now, it's like, and everyone can agree on this. But actually enforcing it and getting it to happen, because that's just so hard to be like, all right, here's the math, here's how I've brought everything in and measured every little bit of this. I have found that to be a difficult thing. It's like, we all know this to be true. And yet to try and get anyone at a startup, really, I found to really internalize that takes a while and takes some good big rocks hitting them before they really get it.
Yeah, it's true. Data tools are getting a lot better. So if you have something like have a churn theorem that will be able to tease out some of the numbers, like this is how much time we're spending this customer, whatever it is that you can figure out, you know, those help support the number. But you have to go through and pull out those data points. And sometimes, you know, building one case study is worthwhile, especially if you are in a sort of front-end sales heavy environment. It does seem to make sense. If you're losing money on customers, then think about, is this good business?
But they don't believe they're losing money on customers. That's the thing.
Right.
They think they're losing money because, well, we employ all these people.
You know, this is always an interesting piece of the conversation is, does your customer-facing team carry a number? If you're generating revenue, if you're managing upsells, or if you're even managing renewals, which I can make arguments on both sides of it, but
same.
You know, if you're if you have a number that you are responsible for, then you have a better seat at the table, because I firmly believe that customer success is a revenue-generating part of the business. But it is an indirectly revenue generating part of business until you have a number. And then you buy into all of the challenges of having somebody who's supposed to be a customer advocate and also a salesperson.
Yeah, I don't love a quota there, but like renewal, I think that's still good. What I have, and this is a tangent, but I have found is logically, yes, it does make sense that we have more of a seat at the table when we own revenue. But again, We own revenue that people think should happen naturally, so they don't necessarily attribute it to us. And we've also taken on this revenue role at the worst economic time over the past two years. My question lately to everyone is like, and has it really given us a seat at the table? I don't feel like it has.
And as soon as you make people responsible for revenue, they're going to veer in the direction that makes them money. Like, that's just human nature. And so now all of a sudden you take these people who are sort of service oriented and relationship driven, and you put a number on them. So now I'm going to argue on the other side of the fence, right? And you say, you got to go hit this number. And now you've got misaligned expectations.
It's competing priorities.
Right. Well, it's not even that they're competing. They're actually in direct opposition.
They are in alignment. They can be in alignment if you're able to get the customer to renew and buy more through things they really need. But a lot of time, it's a little bit over the line of what's actually going to be useful for them. And hey, you still work for a company, so maybe fair, but it really does create a lot of cognitive dissonance within really service-oriented people. And it's something I see a lot of people struggling with.
Yeah. It's in business school that we had a term. It was rewarding A while hoping for B. And that I feel like encapsulates it.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm going to do one more question because I know this is a big pain point, and I just have so much fun talking to you, and I could do this for hours, and I won't do that to you. But right now, a huge issue that a lot of CS people are dealing with is executive sponsor change. How is it possible to leverage this kind of loyalty to have that help you not get knocked out by executive sponsor change?
Executive sponsor change, and I'll also give another shout out to Churn Zero on this one, because I went to Big Rig a couple years ago and they had a presenter who had done like big data analytics. And executive sponsor change, key account change, was the single biggest proactive identifier for churn. Predictive identifier for churn. And so the opportunity is that as soon as you find out that there is going to be a change, then you take action. And I advise my clients to have a play so that you can pull it out of your pocket and run it. Because what the data also showed was that 48 hours was enough of a delta, made enough of a difference to from the first time you got the signal that there was going to be a key account change. If you waited more than 48 hours, your chances of recovering the account went down. So you got a really, really narrow window. And what we know is that when people are not sure what to do, they'll procrastinate. So you want to be able to give people a very, very clear path on what to do as soon as you find out about executive sponsor change, key account change.
I've always advocated, I feel like you probably have a better idea than I do. I've always advocated for double gift baskets on that. One to the outgoing, one to the incoming, to try and get the new play. We'll miss you. We loved working with you. And hey, welcome. Congratulations. Can we have a call with you? But I wonder if you have a better idea.
Well, you can never go wrong with a gift basket, but I think that there's a little bit, right? Who doesn't? Yeah. I like my Active Campaign water bottle, but there's also the business piece. And, there is a business play that you can run, and where, you really are helping the person who's coming in and engaging with them and delivering value to this new person as quickly as possible. So that you're not just saying congratulations, but you're giving them some business nugget so that ideally cuts through the noise and helps them say, oh, this is a product or a tool or a whatever that's going to help me. Mm-hmm. And you just need to get enough of a pattern interrupt to get the meeting and then at least, make your pitch. I will say I have had situations with my clients where we've rolled out the key account change play, and the next day, the most junior person on the team got wind of a key account change, ran the play, and got the meeting. And in the meeting, the person said, I was 100% going to churn, and I'll give you guys an extra, 6 months to prove it out. Like I get what you're saying. This makes sense. And that's all you need. Like you just need to vote. Like you just need a chance.
I love it when people say something where I'm like, why didn't I think of that? But of course. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like, that's one of those. Of course, you give them some business insight that's like, you're coming into this role. You should know this about this aspect of the way your client functions in this arena.
Yeah.
So smart. So cool. I want to do like a good wrap up. I'm going to do two questions. One is, what would you say is your best piece of advice to people who are having trouble treating their customers like anything but a number right now?
You need to have a culture change. If this is cultural, then you need to think about who you want to be as a company. And some companies can't be fixed because they don't want to be fixed. As if you're a CS leader, like, okay, what can I do?
Yeah.
And there are going to be limitations to what you can do in a company that just isn't oriented toward post-sale relationship building. If it's all transactions all the time and sell, then and make them a number, there's only a limited amount of things that you can do and maybe just decide whether or not this is the right company for you, honestly.
And no, I agree.
If you're a leader listening to this, then there's a huge opportunity in what you can do to change the dynamics in your company. And thinking about customer experience as being cross-functional is a good one, right? Like if you really look at what does this customer experience look like from the first point of engagement all the way through the selling relationship, through that transition into onboarding and implementation to adoption and growth, then when you do that right and you build the customer experience correctly, that renewal becomes a no-brainer because you're delivering value consistently.
Yeah. A renewal, I always think like a proposal. If you're having to think about it on the day, the answer is no.
Yeah.
It's like when the question gets asked, if you have to think about it, that's a problem, you know, and it that decision was made a long time ago.
I had a client and they brought me in because they like literally like in the proposal, it was like, we really are having a renewal problem. And I came into the company and I started doing my, digging around and I was like, oh, no, you don't have a renewal problem. You have an onboarding problem.
Almost like, always what I say, but someone says they have a renewal problem.
And truly, like they were losing people almost immediately, but it was a 1 year sale.
Right.
And so they thought, and truly they thought they had a renewal problem. Like, oh, no, not even close.
That's such a great point. It's a huge pain point for so many people.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I've kept you for an hour in our time, and I am sure you have other things to do and a life to lead, but I cannot express how much I love talking to you. I could do it all day, but let people know where they can find you. And I will include that in the show notes, of course, what sort of companies you work best with.
Sure. The company is called Alignment Growth Strategies. And again, it's MINT. And you can find me at alignforgrowth.com, although we are in the process of moving to alignment.co. So depending on when this comes out, you might be able to go to alignment.co, which will be very exciting. But both URLs will work. You can find my book, Keep Your Customers, wherever books are sold. But if you go to keepbook.com, there is a free excerpt that you can download. And it's meatier than the one that you can get on Amazon. And please find me on LinkedIn and let me know that you found me on Rachel's podcast. I can accept your connection request. I don't know about you, but half my connection requests are just sales.
Yeah.
So please just say like podcast in the notes and I will accept your request. And yeah, that's where you find me.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I am going to read your book and I will let you know all of my thoughts, whether you want them or not. And I really hope to talk to you again soon. This was beyond amazing. Thank you so much.
All right. That is all the time we have left for today on Psychology of Customer Success. Thank you so much for joining us. If you need some help diving deeper into how to maximize your CS strategy, team leadership, and executive presence, make sure to hit up probandsuccess.com/CSLA to learn all about the Customer Success Leadership Academy and how we can help you with that. I'll see you next time. In the meantime, get some rest, take care of yourself, and make sure to share this with your CS bestie. Talk soon, and here's to your success.